This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you want to get people at a farmer's market talking, that's pretty easy. Just ask them to name their favorite apple.
The Honeycrisp are like apple fun in your mouth.
It's right here, Ashmead's Kernel. Like a diamond in the rough, I like to call it, because it looks ugly.
It has a gnarly cover on the outside. It's kind of yellow-green.
But its flavor is amazing. It's sweet and tangy at the same time.
If you don't like tart, it's not for you.
Keepsakes are really crisp and delicious.
The wine sap I like because they're different and they have that little tart flavor.
Golden Delicious I'm not a fan of. Isn't that weird? It's like having one child you don't like.
That was apple farmer Lucas Samoskett and a few of his customers at the Hudson Farmers Market in upstate New York. And these days, apple lovers expect more. They expect more than a choice of a red, a yellow, or a green. And you can blame the foodie revolution and the explosion of new apples with flashy names like Sweet Tango, Cosmic Crisp. And today, in the middle of the apple picking season, we ask, where are all of the apple varieties? Where do they all come from? How do breeders use science to build a better apple? And you can do that. And are there even more great-tasting apples out there just waiting to be rediscovered or bred in America's agricultural back catalog? If you have a question about apples, maybe you have a variety. Yeah, maybe you have a variety you want to recommend to us. Give us a call. Our number, 877-724-8255 or 844-SCI-TALK. We'll take your suggestions on, you know, tweet it to us, at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Let me introduce my guests. Susan Brown heads the apple breeding program at Cornell University, where she's also the Herman M. Cohn Professor of Agriculture. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Dan Bussey is the orchard manager at Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa. He's also the author of the forthcoming Illustrated History of Apples in North America, a monumental work of apple scholarship. Welcome to Science Friday, Dan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you get involved in documenting apples, Dan?
Surely by accident, I suppose. I read a book back in about 1979 called Apples and Man by Fred Lape, and it talked about all the varieties of apples that had originated in this country, and I was really captured by the lexicon of the apples, the names that they had. They were so fantastic, black Amish and cow snout, sheep nose, cat's head, just lots of strange ones. And I got really fascinated by it, and I started looking into what they were.
And how many different apples did you come up with?
I have cataloged over 17,000 that have been grown in this country since 1623.
Wow. Susan Brown, why do we have so many diverse apples?
Apples are naturally diverse. They have to outcross, so they have to have pollen from another variety. And so that creates new hybrids and mixes the genetic pot up.
Is it true that if you try to grow an apple tree from the seed of the apple, you will not get the apple it came from?
That's right.
Absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, apples are heterozygous. Yeah. And so when the alleles in the genes match, there's a dominant and a recessive. And when they cross, they come out in all manner of ways. They never come true from seed, very seldom, if ever.
So that means, Susan, that any apple tree we see today is either hundreds of years old or is a cutting, not from a seed of an apple?
Correct. So every apple is a hybrid. And the only way to propagate it and maintain that large diversity that we have is to make a cutting, and then you make a clonal propagule or a clone of that variety.
Is the original Macintosh apple tree still around?
I doubt that it's still around, but every Macintosh tree in the world dates back to that original clone, that original hybrid discovered.
Dan, tell us how you clone an apple tree.
Well, you take a vegetative cutting. You can either do it tissue culture, or you will take a cutting, usually when it's dormant and in late winter, and you can graft it onto a root of an apple species and get it to grow that way.
Mm-hmm. Susan, tell us about some of the most popular varieties of apples we have today, and the steps it takes to actually grow one and bring it to market. It's a long process, isn't it?
It is, but it's getting shorter because we have new technologies and new techniques. So it used to be it could take 40 years, but now the most recent variety that I named, Snapdragon, only took 12 years from making the cross to commercialization.
Hmm. We asked Tatiana Klaxman at the Hudson Farmers Market what she looks for in an apple, and she had this to say about the Honeycrisp.
You know, I sometimes wonder if it's both that it's the flavor but also the sound. So it engages multiple senses. Like, it's nice to eat it, it's delicious, but it also is really satisfying in terms of the crunch, crunch, crunch.
Susan Brownie, how do you go out and find the apple with the varieties that you want and then say, I'm going to grow this thing for market?
Okay. So the case in point with Honeycrisp. Honeycrisp is a wonderful apple. It has a wonderful name. And the reason that it gives that crunch is that the cells rupture instead of breaking between the cells. So that contributes to juiciness and that crunch. So I took Honeycrisp as one parent, but I wanted to give it a little bit more flavor. And Honeycrisp has a huge number of production problems. So I crossed it by a parent that had more flavor. And then literally I plant out thousands and thousands of seedlings looking for that offspring that has the best of both parents but not the faults.
And so you literally have to go out and eat the apple? Every one of those trees? You eat it. How many apples a day do you eat?
Probably close to 1,000. But, of course, we bite and spit. Not very glamorous, but it's what we have to do.
It's like being, it's like wine tasting, I guess. You can't eat them
all.
And so you do 1,000 apples a day, and then you go, Eureka, I found the one I want.
Usually after I complain about my stomach, but yes. In the case of Snapdragon, it was actually the first tree in the row, and my technician and I ate it, and we were like, my God, this is good. And we said, well, will it still be good after we've tried 500 other ones? And it was.
Well, let's go out to the phones. Jonathan in Pittsburgh, PA. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question. I wondered why there's so many different kinds of heirloom apples and many thousands of other kinds of apples. How come we only see a few in grocery stores anymore?
Good question.
That's a sad state of affairs, actually. There are so many really wonderful apples, both new varieties and heirlooms, that it is a shame that we don't have access to more of them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fortunate to have places such as where I work at the Seed Savers Orchard, which has 1,000 varieties in the collection. And the public is welcome to come and sample anything that we have there. And so I think it's a great opportunity for people to come and find out what kind of apples really trip their trigger, as it were.
Yeah,
those ones that they really love. And that's a great opportunity and should be explored with other collections as well.
So you don't collect the seeds of the apple, because we know that you're not going to keep the apple's not going to be the same from the seed. You're actually, you have a tree collection.
We have a tree collection. That's what we do. We've been gathering varieties from all over the world. We have most of them that are local to the United States, of course, in the upper Midwest where we are. And we're trying to find those ones that fill in those gaps of those historic records. And so we do a lot of it as far as the history of apples as they were grown in the Midwest and the United States. But other ones that are just such outstanding flavored apples that we need to have. Oh. The oldest one we have in the orchard dates back to 450 A.D.
Wow. Is it possible that people listening could go into their backyard and have an apple tree that you're looking for?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we'd like to find, is more of those varieties that had a history.
How would you do that? Let's say, I have a backyard or a farm or something. I see apple trees. How do I know whether you need that one or not?
Well, that's always the $1,000 question is, and a lot of people bring me apples to identify, and I can always tell them what it isn't. But the thing is to find out what it is. And so if we can sort of tell how old the tree is and the location of where it was found, we can start to put the pieces together as to what this apple may be. And there are definitely gems out there yet to be found, so many.
Yeah. You rediscovered one of those long-lost apples, the Perkins, right? How did you find that one?
It was a strange thing. It was my grandfather's favorite apple, and I was looking for that for a while. And I'm sort of out of desperation. I put a want ad in the, or a wanted poster, I should say, in the local paper, and I got one call. and a person had it.
One for one.
It worked.
Wow. We have watercolors of a lot of those lost apples. How did that happen?
The USDA, back about 1887, hired watercolor artists to paint apples as people were sending them to the USDA. And it was the only way to faithfully reproduce how these apples looked, because color photography wasn't existing at that point in time. And so these artists would take the apples and paint them in their full color and all their spots and everything else, and kept that record going. And they painted them from 1887 to about in the 1930s, I think, when the last one was done.
Interesting.
And so there's a marvelous record, over almost 2,000 distinct varieties.
And we have a gallery of some of those apples, watercolors, on our website at sciencefriday.com/apples. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to April in Evansville, Indiana. Hi, April.
Hi there. I just was curious to know where the Fuji, or how the Fuji apple came about. It's one of my favorites, and I always seem to go back to it. So how did it get its name, or where did it come from?
Let me ask Susan first.
Yes, thank you. Fuji, it's ironic that Fuji, which was a variety from Japan, actually came from two American varieties that we sent to Japan. So we actually started their apple industry. So it was a case of good neighborhoodness where we shared Delicious and Rawls Janet. They combined those two varieties and made a variety that was synonymous with their country, and then exported it so we could enjoy it as well.
Why are we still raising apples the old-fashioned way, breeding apples the old-fashioned way, back to when they were, you know, those famous experiments with peas? Why is there no more of a genetic or scientific way of doing it now?
Oh, there absolutely is a more scientific way. So we use the same, every breeding program uses the same principles that Mendel did with garden peas, but we can use molecular markers, which are just like forensic and DNA bands. We can use different techniques that will tell us whether the presence or absence of a band on a gel, which is kind of like Jell-O, correlates with a trait. And so I can tell you before I even plant a seed whether it's going to be red or yellow, whether it's going to have disease resistance or not. And it's revolutionizing how we do things. But the beauty is, too, all these old lost varieties, we've still maintained a lot of those genes. So I can tell you that Ashmead's kernel has transmitted that gene to these different progeny. And so it allows us to use that wealth of diversity and not lose it, maybe not in its present form. And then the other aspect is USDA has a collection of 3,000, actually 4,000 varieties that we as breeders and geneticists use to understand how are these traits done and how can we use them to improve things like dealing with climate change or improving quality.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about apples, everything you wanted to know about apples this hour with Dan Bussey and Susan Brown. But still, when you breed them, are you still taking the old-fashioned way of taking pollen from one flower and sticking it on another flower?
Yeah, if you thought eating all those apples was tedious, we remove the pollen with a comb, flower after flower, and then we have to take it to another tree, which we've removed the petals and the anthers so that bees don't come. And we all have to do that within a two-week period. So there's a lot of anxiety in spring at Cornell, but we've been doing it since 1880, and we have a wonderful track record. So sometimes old methods work exceptionally well.
But that's just the beginning, because you have to wait until that that new tree puts out a fruit to test it
out, right?
You have to take the bite.
Right. That's 4 years. That's not so bad.
I guess you're right. And then if you find that that's the magical fruit you're looking for, then you have to graft all those other trees.
So we graft it, but we can graft hundreds and we can get them out to the industry right away. So, you know, yes, you have to be patient, but I say that you have to be impatient. So once I see something that's good, we make lots of copies, we send it out to growers, and we get consumer feedback on it early in the process.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 844-724-8255. Let me ask you a question about the phrase, the rotten apple in the barrel. You know, it's bad. There's always one rotten apple. Is that how it works? Can one rotten apple spoil the rest of the barrel?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
What's going on there?
Apples give off ethylene, which is a gas, and it causes other fruits to ripen. So I always tell people, even President Obama has a bowl of apples on his desk, but that means that those apples are deteriorating quickly. So to stop that process, you stick your apples in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. It stops those gases from developing, and it halts the ripening process.
Dan, are there a few old apples you think should be better known? What should we look for in our farmer's market?
Look for those ones that basically you just enjoy eating, those ones that just have that really great flavor and that lovely texture that just feels right in your mouth. And there are so many different things that people like. Taste is so subjective, of course. And I think the thing we have to get past is the idea of eating with our eyes, because there are so many apples that may not be the most attractive looking in the world. But once you get past that sort of dull and dark skin, the flavors underneath are very rich and rewarding. And that's a joy, serious joy.
I've heard a lot of people say that whatever happened to Red Delicious, it's red, but it's not delicious anymore.
Well, the original one we have is the Hawkeye Delicious, and I have to admit it's not one of my favorite ones either. Even though Old Man Stark picked it out from that exhibition he was doing, and it was sent to him, and he really, really loved it. And we have that original strain, which is a Striped Delicious, which you don't usually see a striped-looking delicious. It has a nice sweet flavor, but it has kind of a thick, bitter skin. But strange thing enough that it totally revolutionized the apple industry. Red Delicious was grown within 20 years of it being introduced almost everywhere.
Can it grow so much that it loses its flavor? Or do you graft it so much?
What happened a lot was there were Red Delicious had this way of throwing out spores, slightly different genetic variations in a particular branch or bud that the fruit would color up, maybe it's more of a solid color. It might ripen a little bit sooner. And different characteristics that you could get it to market sooner and have a leg up on your competition. The downside was flavor was never one of those components that it was actually chosen for.
Mm. All right, we're going to talk lots more about apples with Dan Bussey and Susan Brown. Our number is 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be crunching our way back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about apples. Can science help us achieve a crisper, sweeter apple? How about a more tart apple? My guests are Susan Brown, professor of agriculture and head of the apple breeding program at Cornell University, Dan Bussey, orchardist with the Seed Savers Exchange, author of the forthcoming Apple Epic, Illustrated History of Apples in North America. And our phone number is 844-724-8255. Let me ask you, Susan, first, is there an apple out there that you still yet are looking for? That you and what's your dream?
Always. Always. So we have, when you're asking, boulders. So we have boulder flavors. We have unique flavors. We have some that are very spicy and might be suited for both fresh eating and cider. But I would like to produce an apple that has high quality and is consistent but appeals to the younger generation, because they're still not eating enough apples. And so having something with much more of a sugar acid balance and perhaps bold flavors could be equivalent to a natural shuck tart type of apple.
Dan, do you have any one that you're looking for? Did you like to
find? Oh, lots. A couple in mind. One is actually kind of local to Wisconsin, a variety called Delavan. Its juice was noted to stick to your hands like molasses. And another variety is the Golden Wilding. It was one of Thomas Jefferson's favorite cider varieties. Mixed with the Hughes crab, it was absolutely superior in his mind. Mm-hmm. And I would love to find that one.
Let me see if I get one more call in. Let's go to Highlands, North Carolina. Ken, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I was going to put out five or six Red and Delicious trees and was wondering if your guests could recommend another variety that would help cross-pollinate.
Oh, you're starting your own orchard, is what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, Susan, Dan, a hint for him? What he should be doing?
Anything else, any other variety besides the Red Delicious, or if that's what you were planning, would be a good one to pollinate. Crab apples typically are good pollinators.
Any variety except sports of Red Delicious, because they have to be genetically different.
Okay, Ken, does that work for you?
It does, and I guess their opinion on the Red and Delicious as well, or maybe should I mix it up even more?
Never hurts to. I think that's the joy of it, is the difference in the varieties that you'll find.
It's important that they bloom at the same time.
Most of the time, they're very close to each other, but yeah, it's good to have some that are at the exact same time.
Yeah, it depends on the region. So in our region, they can be separate quite a bit.
I didn't realize that a crab apple is a real apple. I don't know why. I used to have them on my lawn all the time. But it is a real apple, a tiny little apple.
Right. And they contain sources of resistance that we use in breeding. So, for example, to the scab that a lot of apples get if it rains in the spring. And so those crab apples in our repository have been used to give resistance to a lot of different pathogens.
Some of the crabs with the high tannins are sort of have antifungal properties as well.
Antifungal properties.
Yep.
So they're more resistant to it then.
A little bit more so.
Mm-hmm. What can we do to help preserve some of these old apple varieties that we're talking so much about? Dan?
I think basically just be aware where you find them. Can you tell, is it an old tree? Has it been around a long time? Can you see that it's been grafted? If you see a graft union, which is sort of a change in the color or a bump in the bark below the first set of scaffold branches, at least you will have an idea that it was a cultivated grafted tree versus a wild seedling, which could just sprout from somebody pitching an apple out of their car as they're driving after eating it.
Susan, Dan, we've run out of time. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Fascinating.
Thank you very much.
Susan Brown, Professor of Agriculture at Cornell University, where she also heads the Apple Breeding Program. And Dan Bussey is Orchard Manager at Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa. He's also author of the forthcoming Illustrated History of Apples in North America.